loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about the aftermath of the Putin-Trump Helsinki summit. We'll go through the firestorm and analyze what's going on and what comes next. And then it's our weekly Tuesday series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, House Speaker Paul Ryan late last night quashed a rank-and-file effort to force a vote sponsored by a progressive Democrat that would abolish immigration and customs enforcement. Ryan concluded that while the bill had no chance of passing, Republicans could be embarrassed if Democrats opposed it in large numbers. Next, Maria Butina, a Russian woman who tried to arrange a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin during the 2016 presidential campaign, was arrested by the FBI on Sunday. The Justice Department says that Butina is a Russian intelligence officer or was acting for one who was tasked with infiltrating important U.S. institutions. Then Israel further tightened its blockade on Gaza yesterday, preventing gas and fuel deliveries through its only commercial crossing. When Israel announced the closing on July 9th, it promised to allow food, water, medicine, and fuel. That changed yesterday. And then the Iranian government said today that it is preparing to increase the level of uranium enrichment if negotiations with Europe on sanctions fall through. Meanwhile, Iran has filed a complaint with the International Court of Justice to, quote, hold the U.S. accountable for its unlawful reimposition of unilateral sanctions, unquote, according to the country's foreign minister. And finally, Elon Musk jumped into a scandal of his own making last week when he called a British cave diver who was instrumental in the rescue of a dozen Thai Boy Scouts from a flooded cave a pedophile. When called to task over the comment, he doubled down and repeated it. And in other headlines, thousands of Amazon workers in several European countries went on strike today, protesting low pay and poor working conditions. Today was chosen as the day of the strike because it is Prime Day, a major sales promotion for the company. Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, is the richest person in the world. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch has vowed to take action against the Trump administration's protectionist trade policies. Hatch said, quote, if the administration continues forward with its misguided and reckless reliance on tariffs, I will work to advance trade legislation to curtail presidential trade authority, unquote. Senator Hatch has widely been seen as a staunch Trump ally, but this latest statement is evidence of fraying ties. The Syrian government retook a key strategic position near the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. This area is the highest ground in Daraa province and was taken by insurgents in 2014. State media announced the capture yesterday. Protesters continue to take to the streets in several major Iraqi cities, protesting corruption, a lack of clean water, and economic deprivation generally. The protests have been concentrated in the oil-rich but economically underdeveloped south of the country, and at least 8 people have been killed. The political situation in Iraq is fragile ahead of a controversial recount of the votes in this year's election. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Helsinki summit. We're going to do a follow-up discussion from yesterday's summit between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump returned last night to a firestorm of criticism, mostly from members of his own Republican Party, well, and the Democratic Party, and the media, predominantly everyone in the U.S. Political and media establishment. Trump said publicly after his meeting with Putin that he did not believe Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election. And when asked by a reporter who's the U.S. greatest foe, he said it was the European Union or something like that. Today, and just now, just minutes ago, Donald Trump came out of a meeting with members of Congress and, in fact, said he does accept the U.S. intelligence agency's estimate that Russia, or that they have a high degree of confidence that Russia indeed interfered in the U.S. election. We're joined in studio by Joe Loria. He is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And we're joined from Washington, D.C. by Peter Kuznick. Peter is a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. And he's the co-author with Oliver Stone of the book and the hit Showtime television series, The Untold History of the United States. Joe and Peter, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
Joe Loria, let's start with you. Donald Trump, as I said just minutes ago this afternoon, after meeting with members of Congress and after being hammered by both parties and by the media for appearing to be, as they put it, basically on Team Russia instead of Team America, he changed his tune. He said, yes, he does accept U.S. intelligence estimates that the Russians interfered with the 2016 elections. What's your takeaway?
Just last week, I heard Professor Stephen Cohen, emeritus of Princeton and NYU, on a radio show saying that there were top advisors to President Putin, including in the military, who did not want this summit to go ahead because they were afraid of Trump changing his mind the next day and that he can't be trusted and he's just a wild card and it's a waste of time, basically. I'm not saying I agree with that, but he's changed his mind today, hasn't he?
Yeah. Peter Kuznick, go ahead.
Well, you know, a lot of folks, especially those who are sympathetic to improving relations between the United States and Russia, were pretty ecstatic about yesterday's press conference and summit. I guess I don't fall into that camp. While I was certainly glad that they were meeting, that they were going to be talking about the issues between us right now, which are very, very serious, I think that yesterday's summit was a disaster for U.S.-Russian relations. As you mentioned, it managed. Trump's behavior has been so erratic. You know, some people have just dismissed him as a fool for what he's been doing. Others are now accusing him of treason. And you have to put this summit in the context of what he's been doing recently. You've got the G7 meeting in Canada, followed by, which Trump blew up, followed by the NATO meeting, which Trump goes and accuses Angela Merkel of basically betraying NATO and with her energy deal with Russia. And then he goes to England. I just got back from England. I spent 8 or 9 days there on a speaking tour, and I was there when Trump arrived. And he goes there and he insults Theresa May. I'm certainly no big Theresa May fan, but he starts extolling the virtues of Boris Johnson. And just the whole thing was ludicrous there again. So after that occurs, then Trump goes to Helsinki to meet with Putin. And I was very disappointed because this is not going to be advancing the cause of improved relations between the United States and Russia, which is absolutely essential right now. What this is doing is uniting Trump's opponents, and especially those who don't want to see improved relations, giving them more fodder, and nothing concrete is going to come out of this. Nothing concrete really came out of it. The disappointment is not only with Donald Trump, because he's a fool, but with Vladimir Putin, who's not a fool and should have seen the outcome of this, should have anticipated what was coming. And so I'm very disappointed. I think this is going to ultimately be a setback in U.S.-Russian relations. And as we can talk about, there are so many areas in which we need to cooperate now to make some progress in the world.
Okay, Joe Loria, I guess what Peter is saying, that Donald Trump, based on his conduct at the G7, his conduct at NATO, and then what happened in D.C., and President Putin, perhaps as a consequence of unintended consequences, for having met with Putin and wanting to improve relations, it's turning into its opposite. And thus, in all ways, the summit was a setback. I think, Peter, am I sort of generalizing your comments properly?
Yeah. I think you are, because on the one hand, he's united the opposition in a way that he wasn't able to do before that. You've got not only Brennan and people like that calling this treasonous, you've got even Republicans who are almost at that point.
Let me throw it to Joe. Let me just ask you, Joe, if Peter's right, how does one sort of change the political climate towards better U.S.-Russia relations under these circumstances? And do you agree with him about what's happened?
I agree when he said at the beginning, Peter did, that he was glad they met. I think it's way too premature to say that this was a failure. We have to see what comes out of this in terms of special arms control. Will this lead to extension of START 2? They talked about Syria. There's supposedly a Netanyahu saw Putin before he saw Trump, and there's supposedly a deal in the works where the Russians would try to get the Iranians to back away from the northern Golan Heights, where in exchange, Netanyahu would recognize Bashar al-Assad as president. In fact, he even said that after summit, that there's no problem if he stays, and there's Ukraine. So we can't tell yet for sure whether this has happened, and we don't know whether this was a success or not. And I think no matter what happened, this was uniting the opposition. The opposition was to Trump was united before the summit when the indictments came down on Friday, clearly timed to try to stop this summit from happening. They were within 1 hour, Chuck Schumer was saying he has to cancel. That's the intention of that indictment without question, which of course gives
And that was the indictment of the 12 Russian GRU agents.
Right. So I think, again, we don't know what the outcome of the summit is going to be. What could improve Russian-U.S. relations at this point? I really don't know, because I think they had to meet. We have to hope that they will follow up and that Trump's people, his administration, will be able to follow up on whatever strides they made towards arms control in Ukraine and Syria, and that something good could come out of this. But I think it's important to show the world that these two nuclear powers and 90% of the nuclear weapons can meet and discuss things the way they always did during the Cold War. Every president has met with the Russian or Soviet leader. I don't see why that's different, and I think that has to happen. And unfortunately, the absolute mania that this has unleashed in the media has been extraordinary. I don't think in my lifetime have seen anything like this, even worse than the lead up to the invasion of Iraq.
Peter, let's go through this because there's a lot of nuance. It's not just about overall perspective on U.S.-Russian relations. It's also about strategy. It's about tactics. Joe Loria, of course, is right. Since the Tehran summit in 1943 between Stalin, Churchill and Roosevelt, every U.S. president has engaged in some summitry with either the Soviet leadership, now the Russian leadership. And yet we're in this era where even if Trump had said nothing, he probably would have been slammed, no?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, there were people who were out to sabotage this, as Joe was saying, before it occurred. You've got the foreign policy establishment, the CFR types, and the neocons, most of whom are strongly opposed to the kind of progress that Joe and I would like to see in the relationship. So, yes, they were up against a lot. But then I think that Trump fed the worst tendencies and gave them more fodder for their attack on the kinds of things that we would like to see happening. The Syrian situation, as Joe was saying, is a little bit more promising. My speaking tour in England, I was with Peter Ford, the former UK ambassador to Syria, and with Eva Bartlett, terrific independent journalist who covers Syria extensively. And clearly the sense I got from Ambassador Ford was that we're closer to a potential resolution of the crisis in Syria than we've been for a long time. I don't want to see that undermined. What Ford was saying is that the government now controls 80%, that the 20%, as Joe was saying, in the northern part and the pockets that the terrorists still control are going to be militarily eliminated, hopefully within the next year. And the last time I was in Russia was on Victory Day. I brought 20 students to Moscow with me. Another person who was in Moscow for Victory Day was Netanyahu. So clearly, Russia is working with Israel. And the deal, as Joe suggested, was going to be to pull the U.S. troops out in exchange for the Iranian troops leaving Syria. That would be good. The Kurds in the north are already in negotiations with Damascus. They realize that they're going to have to come back into the fold to some extent. So they'll have more autonomy. And for the first time in years, we see the possibility of a resolution of the Syrian crisis. And that would be good. The other thing that Joe raised that I strongly agree with is that we need to make progress on the nuclear front. As I calculated, the U.S. and Russia have 93% of the world's nuclear weapons. And when Trump and Putin had that first phone conversation, and Putin suggested that we extend the New START treaty after it expires in 2021. Trump put down the phone, asked his advisor, well, what's the New START treaty? Didn't even know what it was. And then he gets back on. He says, no, it's not a good deal. We don't want to extend it. So if they're going to be talking about doing that, that would also be very, very positive, especially in the aftermath of the U.S. coming out with its nuclear posture review this past February. And then Putin, in his State of the Nation address on March 1st, unveiling the fact that Russia now has 5 new nuclear weapons, all of which can circumvent America's ballistic missile defense system. So the crisis is not getting eased. As you guys know, the Pentagon recently announced that terrorism is not the main threat to the United States. We've changed that now. Now we say that Russia and China pose the main threat to the United States.
So, you have some hope that something good could come out of the summit then?
Yes, but I think that that we were moving more in that direction before the summit. What I see happening now, what worries me, is that anything good that might be proposed, Congress is going to try to sabotage.
Because of the summit.
Yeah, I think the summit is going to feed that, is my fear.
But they had to talk about START, too. They had to meet. They had to meet.
No, I wanted them to meet. I've been calling, every trip I go to Russia and every interview I do, I've been pushing Putin to call for a summit, to have a summit with
Trump. So it's not Trump's fault that there's been this unbelievably maniacal opposition to his meeting, then.
I mean, but the way he handled the meeting is what I don't like.
You mean the press conference?
The press conference, especially, yes.
How could he handle that better?
He could have handled it better by not, first of all, dismissing their intelligence reports out of hand and going along with Putin. You can say that the accusations about Russian meddling have been vastly exaggerated, that Russian interference, he could have put it in some context. I think that would have been good to do. But I think the way he did it, undermining the American intelligence community and also kowtowing to Putin in the way he did, was sure to get the kind of response that he got, with Brennan and others coming out accusing him of treason. He didn't have to be so egregious in his behavior.
Well, he's at war with the intelligence community, clearly. They want to delegitimize his election with these completely unproven allegations. Even this indictment, an indictment is not by law evidence, and you don't have to put evidence into an indictment. But it's, again, going back to just taking the word of unnamed intelligence officials. We know that this indictment was never intended to go to court because they're never going to arrest these 12 guys. So this is a political document intended to settle into the public consciousness guilt by Russia. And Trump's ticked off about that. That's his style, clearly. But I think they were going to kill him no matter what he did, be honest with you, just by going to the summit was enough. Even if you had handled it the way you did, I don't think that would have blunted any criticism whatsoever. They were ready to get him as soon as that press conference came was over. The way Anderson Cooper said it was the most disgraceful performance he's ever seen of an American president. This is not what a journalist is supposed to say. If you want to attack him or criticize him, there are ways to do it. And he was going to face that criticism no matter what. This unbelievable and I'll give you one example, if I can, this collusion issue. There was nothing in the indictment about that. Rod Rosenstein made it clear that no Americans were charged in this and that there's no evidence, at least now, or any indictments of Americans in this collusion. But yet the New York Times and many other outlets still pushed this idea that when Trump said on July 27, 2016, when he called out on TV, Russia, if you have to go get the 30,000 emails, that perhaps was some collusion. Now, the idea that an intelligence operation would be triggered when Trump on national TV, worldwide TV, would start this operation with a command to the Russians is on its face absurd. The Russians would not need anybody's help if it was a remote hack. But most secondly, someone pointed out, Representative Press on Twitter, that the Justice Department seized the computers, that very server, a year ago, before that, in 2015, and it was offline. They were studying it. There was no way anybody could have hacked it in July 2016. But that shows the desperation, I think, of the Democrats and their media to find this collusion there, because they've been going on and on about it, and there's no evidence of that we have seen whatsoever, nor have we seen any solid evidence that Russia was behind it. Maybe this is true, but we'll never know because it will never come to court, this indictment.
That's the voice of Joe Loria. Joe is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry. He's the author of the book, How I Lost, by Hillary Clinton. And we're also joined from Washington by Peter Kuznick. Peter is a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. And he's the co-author with Oliver Stone of the book and the hit Showtime television series, The Untold History of the United States. Peter, before we come back to you, I want to play a short audio clip from Trump when asked at that press conference that we're discussing about whether he believed the U.S. intelligence agencies in terms of their estimate on the alleged interference by Russia in the 2016 election campaign. Let's listen to Trump and then we'll go back to you.
I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all. Everybody knows it. People are being brought out to the fore. So far that I know, virtually none of it related to the campaign. And they're going to have to try really hard to find somebody that did relate to the campaign. That was a
Okay, so Peter, that's the part of the press conference that the media has been and the other political leaders of both parties are hammering Trump for, standing next to Putin. They're arguing, making the case that he's on Team Russia instead of supporting his own intelligence agencies. And again, when we go back, this is what I think in terms of why Trump did this. I mean, he said at the beginning, I didn't have to come here. It was I was going to pay a price politically. That's, I think, how he opens his statement at the press conference. But he said, in the pursuit of peace, it's better to sacrifice politics than to sacrifice peace for political purposes. Now, whatever. I mean, that's the demagogy of a political operative speaking. But nonetheless, he didn't have to come. And it seems to me that one of the things that Trump is demonstrating is that he actually thinks better relations with Russia make sense, that there's a congruence, that they are not necessarily trusting each other, but there's reasons to work together. When George W. Bush came into office, he said he looked into Putin's eyes and could see his soul. And obviously, the U.S. government then and since then has found reasons to collaborate with Russia. President Obama, Hillary Clinton presented Lavrov with that big red reset button, said they wanted to improve relations. Why are we here, Peter? Why are we in a situation where somebody just an American head of state, a meeting with a Russian head of state, even if Trump had done, and I think we all agree here, even if Trump hadn't spoken the way he spoke, he would have still been hammered. Why are we here? Why is this happening?
Well, the roots of this go back to 1990, really, when Gorbachev met with Baker and got a promise that NATO would not expand one thumb's width to the east if they allowed Germany to unify. During the 1990s was a disastrous period for Russia, in which the United States supported Yeltsin. The economy collapsed, standard of living collapsed. The United States ran roughshod over Russia in the 1990s and intervened in their politics very, very flagrantly and blatantly. And since then, once Putin took office, things began to change in Russia. But the United States did not have respect for Russia. The United States felt it could still steamroll Russia. And we didn't respect any of their red lines. And so in 2000, so NATO begins expanding 13 countries to the east. The neocons were ecstatic about this. Then in 2008, Bush says we're going to expand NATO to Ukraine and Georgia. That was further than Putin was able to tolerate. And so when the developments begin in Ukraine, the Russians stand up. The Russians, but there were a lot of other things going on. In 2006, you've got the article in Foreign Affairs magazine by Liberum Press, in which they say that the United States has finally achieved a first strike capability against Russia. That if the United States attacks Russia with nuclear weapons, neither Russia nor China would even be able to retaliate against the United States. We've got this a period there where the United States felt like it was the unipolar power, that it could dictate to the world and was able to achieve anything it wanted, and completely disregarded Russia's own sense of its national security interests. And Putin has responded to that. He's responded militarily, he's responded strategically, he stood up, especially in Eastern Europe. And so the United States went back with expanding NATO, sending thousands more troops, the United States and its allies, into Eastern Europe, into the Baltics, and the crisis in Syria, the crisis in Ukraine. We've got all of these very, very dangerous situations, which is why we need this kind of cooperation now between the United States and Russia. It's a very dangerous period. And so while Trump, on the one hand, says the right things about wanting to improve relations between the United States and Russia, look what's happened since Trump has come into office. The United States has dramatically increased sanctions. We've increased airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. We tore up the Iran nuclear deal, which Russia was instrumental in negotiating. We rejected Putin's offer to expand the New START treaty. We started to provide lethal aid to Ukraine, provoked the North Korean crisis before we backed down from that, increased the number of American troops in Afghanistan, and named Russia and China as our number one threats. So we've got a situation now in which the world is much more dangerous than it was even a few years ago. And so that's why I want to see, I desperately want to see progress. And on the one hand, Trump says he wants to improve relations, but I'm afraid that relations under Trump have only gotten worse, despite Trump's own statements that this is so important to him and some of his actions, which are contradicted by other actions.
Okay, like, let's bring Joe Luria in. That was the voice of historian and professor Peter Kuznick. Joe Luria, go ahead.
Well, I agree everything that Peter just said. That is the geopolitical context in which this is happening. The Wall Street, and it's teaming up with oligarchs in Russia. In the 1990s, asset stripped the country, enriched themselves, and impoverished the country. And Putin came and restored economic and political sovereignty and is standing in the way of U.S. designs. They'd like to, I think, get back a Yeltsin-like figure in power. So here comes Trump saying that he wants to get along better with Russia. But Peter is absolutely correct. Things have gotten worse because of all the things he enumerated right there. And that is quite strange. So does he really want improved relations with Russia? Is he capable of bringing that? That's the issue here. He may have had some good discussions with Putin, but will his administration be able to bring that to Putin? Now, I just should put on the record here that it's possible to take a nonpartisan position against Trump and to oppose him on taxes, healthcare, climate, Iran, Palestine, immigration, defense spending. But the two things he says that one has to support, even if he's not able to pull it off, or it doesn't look like he is North Korea and Russia, to try to reduce tensions in both those areas. I think that the country has to support him on that. And we're seeing the exact opposite, which is so dangerous, coming from the media, from members of Congress, from former officials like Brennan, who are basically calling for his arrest when his plane arrived last night here in Washington.
He was. Comments made it sound, he said, where are the patriots in the Republican Party? It was kind of a call to arms. And also, we had the indictment, Joe, as you mentioned, and Peter will bring you in on this, the 12 indictments of the Russian GRU agents. Putin addressed that. He said, well, if you have evidence, bring it here. We'll let you interview them. And likewise, we want to interview Russians who may have done something or Americans who may have done something to Russia illegally. There's an extradition treaty. In other words, there's a process in place. But then we had yesterday the arrest of this other young woman, Maria Butina, who was basically trying to improve, it sounds like, Russian-U.S. relations, which had gone south so much. She was 29 years old. And I'm looking at the complaint, Joe Luria. I'll just toss it back to you real quick because we only have 3 minutes, and then I'll give Peter the last word. She's actually, it appears to be, an opponent of Putin. She was endorsed by Navalny, the leading candidate and leading opposition figure. I mean, is it a case of people are being arrested for politicking while being Russian?
Well, I hope that the prosecutors realize that about her political persuasion. If they didn't, this looks to me like individual lives are being ruined here in the pursuit of this geopolitical strategy and this mania against Russia and stopping Trump from doing anything positive about it. I think I don't know all the details. I don't know whether she'll be convicted, but this will probably come to court because she lives here in Washington. She's been arrested. So we're going to have a legal resolution of this one way or the other, which will not happen with the 12 indicted GRU agents. That, again, was never intended to be a real legal document, but more of a political statement. And I think in this case, we'll see whether they really have any evidence against her.
Peter Kuznick, 90 seconds left. All of this and all the things you just documented, in spite of Trump saying he wants better relations, in fact, things are far, far worse. And we also have the quadrennial report from the Pentagon and the new national security strategy now identifying not terrorism, but Russia and China. Major power confrontation is the big priorities for the Pentagon. It's a pretty dangerous moment in American history, world history. 40 seconds left.
It's a very dangerous moment. In January of this year, the Bolden atomic scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock to 2 minutes before midnight. And conditions, situations since then, maybe the crisis in Korea has eased somewhat temporarily, hopefully better than that. But overall, the situation has not gotten better. If we can resolve the situation in Syria, that would be fabulous. If we can make some progress on the nuclear front, that would be wonderful. If we can begin to, I mean, we've got to change the situation with Iran. I don't know what Trump is thinking. Yeah. That regard.
That's going to be big. Peter, we're completely out of time. That was the voice of Peter Kuznick. Peter is a professor of history, director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He's the co-author with Oliver Stone of the book and the hit Showtime television series, The Untold History of the United States. And we've been joined here in studio by Joe Loria. Joe is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry. And he's also the author of the book, How I Lost, by Hillary Clinton. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today is Tuesday. That means we continue our weekly series that takes place every Tuesday in the second half hour of our first hour. The segment is called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined once again from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Daniel, real big trade news today. The EU and Japan have signed an agreement that flies in the face of the perhaps emergingly dominant trend of protectionism. Let's talk about what they agreed to.
Yeah, essentially, they agreed to a trade agreement that eliminates almost 100%. It's like 99% of tariffs that cost the EU and Japan about $1.17 billion annually. So there were various protectionist tariffs that they had against one another's industries to try to protect those industries domestically to keep them strong against foreign competition. And they've decided to essentially get rid of a huge portion of those. So what that means is agricultural imports and exports will no longer have tariffs. So the countries will be able to import those from one another with a lot less cost. There's also infrastructure projects such as railroads being built that now foreign investors and foreign companies can get on to export, you know, all the various commodities needed to build those complicated projects. It's a pretty huge deal. I think we don't want to overstate it because one of the contexts we might say is, oh, well, you know, Trump's imposing all these tariffs and now these countries are kind of going to one another and entering free trade agreements because the U.S. is not playing ball the way they used to. This deal has been in conversation for about 4 years, so it's not a Trump phenomena. That being said, I definitely think there is a certain fanfare to it and a certain kind of, I don't know, flexing of muscles of these countries towards the United States, which is imposing all these tariffs and letting the U.S. know, hey, you know, we can also do business with one another. We can also trade with one another as a way of kind of pushing back against Trump's protectionist policies. So it's a big deal. It'll increase trade between them significantly. The U.S. is still the, you know, 800-pound gorilla in the room with a huge economy and huge amounts of importing power. So this isn't to say that it's some kind of fundamental shift, but it is a significant change.
So, Daniel, is this supposed to be some kind of a message to the Chinese, the European Union and others, maybe Mexico and Canada, that if you play ball with Donald Trump, you'll get your free trade agreement? If you don't play ball, you're going to see protectionist sanctions and other tight trade measures?
Well, I think the current administrations and the current kind of powerful bureaucrats in charge of the EU and Japan, respectively, especially the EU, is very pro-free trade and is very distressed by all the tariffs that Donald Trump is putting in and is trying to do some kind of complex dance. Japan has a much more of a kind of nationalist party in power right now. It might be more consistent, we could say, with sort of Donald Trump's ideology, although that's a gross oversimplification. That being said, the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, is very distressed by the tariffs and the aggressive stance that the U.S. is taking. That is also impacting Japan tremendously. So Japan has been very frustrated with it. Japan is, of course, a very staunch ally of the United States ever since being defeated in World War II, and so has been really frustrated and upset with it. I don't think this is a sign that if you, you know, make nice with Donald Trump, you're going to be left alone and allowed to pursue your free trade. Donald Trump is willing to hit back at longtime allies that really kind of did nothing to provoke him and is really kind of pursuing his own agenda. So I think there's a real lack of trust by other countries towards the Trump administration and that they just can't trust what he's going to do next. And he's not going to behave in a predictable way that they can anticipate. So I think it's a very chaotic situation for them.
Who are the losers with free trade? Because if the different industries have protection, that means there is protection. Those industries are not subject to just competition from whoever can produce commodities cheaper, meaning at lower value or with a lower amount of average socially necessary labor. Who then are the losers?
Ultimately, the losers are the workers of the various protected industries. So in this case, now workers have to compete with foreign workers who, and whichever working group is willing to do it for less, essentially be more exploited than the other, is the group that wins. So agricultural industries that are protected by tariffs, the workers enjoy a certain degree of protection, a certain degree of dominance over their domestic market. But then you remove those tariffs, you remove those protections. Now the workers have to compete with the workers in the foreign country. This is classically what we see in our competition with China, where workers that are able to be more exploited in China than they are in the United States beat United States workers. So ultimately, those are who are hurt. The corporations that are protected will see their profits sink as those artificially inflated, those tariffs that artificially inflate their competitors' prices go away. So their competitors' prices drop significantly. They're going to see a huge hit to their pocketbook, a huge hit in profits. And that's going to trickle down to the workers who are in turn going to be hurt by reduced wages, reduced benefits, et cetera.
This is an issue that's gone on for a long time within national economies, within different sectors of manufacturers, different sectors of the landed gentry, industrialists. And of course, it impacts labor and labor unions. In this case, and with Donald Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum, they may be, and I think they are, very popular, especially for areas, communities, and workers who are working in steel and aluminum. They feel they're already threatened jobs may last at least somewhat longer. And yet we have a situation where, well, let's just put it this way. Back in the day of Karl Marx, since we've talked before about socialist economics, Marx had a particular position, which was he was for free trade. And I want to read why Marx, who, of course, is, you know, perhaps the most well-known 19th century economist, but also a partisan of labor and a partisan of the labor movement. I want to read a little bit about what he said about this issue, because it was dividing the labor movement at that time, just as it's divided the labor movement and progressive movements now. To sum up, what is free trade under the present conditions of society? Again, this is Marx. It is the freedom of capital. When you have torn down the few national barriers which still restrict the free development of capital, you will merely have given it complete freedom of action. So long as you let the relation of wages and labor to capital exist, no matter how favorable the conditions under which you accomplish the exchange of commodities, there will always be a class which exploits and a class which is exploited. It is really difficult to understand the presumption of the free traders who imagine that the more advantageous application of capital will abolish the antagonism between industrial capitalists and wage workers. On the contrary, the only result will be that the antagonism of these two classes will stand out more clearly. Now, that's a mouthful, but it's an interesting concept, because one of the issues in globalization under, I mean, globalization has been going on since 1492, since Columbus set sail. And as a consequence, many, many things have happened in the world. The world has changed profoundly. But one of the principal features of contemporary modern globalization is there is something called the race to the bottom. You try to defend your industry and your jobs by producing commodities at a cheaper rate than somebody else, and you accept lower wages as a result, as a consequence, so that your commodity, the commodity that your boss is selling, is more competitive on the world market. But at the end of the day, if capital has all the power and labor has none of the power, if there's the sort of accumulation of wealth at one pole and the accumulation of misery at the other pole, and the workers in China and Europe and the United States and Latin America are simply competing against each other to have the lowest possible wage in that race to the bottom, the only beneficiaries are capital. And the workers of all countries actually get poorer. So I think it's important when we look at tariffs or protectionism versus free trade to also establish sort of the existing class context, which doesn't, as Marx is pointing out here, it doesn't change at all just because a particular industry has an advantage of an industry filled with workers from a different country. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make, is that freedom of movement of capital that we talk about. So investors can move their money anywhere, anytime, any place. This is the kind of dream of free trade, that there's no more state barriers in between it. But why are those state barriers there? And for countries wherein they are representing the majority of the desires of their citizens, where they're really controlled by their citizens and not necessarily by some, you know, autocrat or some, you know, wealthy, powerful class, they're going to erect barriers that protect the people in those countries, that keep them from being exploited by and abused by that capital that's moving around. And of course, the owners of capital hate this because it's another barrier to them. They want to be able to move everywhere. I think one of the things we talk about is everyone's for free trade. Everyone's for free movement of capital in the powerful, you know, ruling class and elite. But what they're not for is the free movement of people. All of a sudden, people, workers, aren't allowed to move wherever they want. They have to go through complex bureaucratic processes. They get deported. They get imprisoned. They get separated from their families. Workers should be forced to adhere to a particular geographic locale, adhere to whatever their poor circumstances are there. They shouldn't have the freedom of movement that capital has. I think also it's a false dichotomy to pit workers here in the United States against, say, workers in China. And this race to the bottom that you referenced, this sort of who can be exploited more? And if we can be exploited more than some poor factory workers in, you know, Shenzhen that have worked 16-hour shifts or whatever, then somehow workers here should be excited about that or grateful that all their factory jobs are coming here so they can also get exposed to toxic chemicals and exhaust themselves and wear themselves out. That's a false dichotomy, and that is not a struggle worth having. We shouldn't be excited about the opportunity to be exploited more or who gets to be exploited more. Really, workers here need to see and understand that they're in solidarity with, that they're in the same conditions as workers all over the world who are being exploited, and that really their common fight is that capital, which is allowed to move everywhere, whereas they are not allowed to. They're confined to their locales. So it's really important that we kind of explode that dichotomy and try to stop trying to make it one against the other, because it most certainly isn't.
All right, Daniel, let's go on with a couple of the other stories of the week. Where do you want to take us next?
I wanted to talk a little bit about this article in the Wall Street Journal that's talking about Wall Street is raising more cash than ever for its rental home gambit. What it's really talking about is various investment firms have been buying up properties. These are big, huge private equity firms with billions of dollars, buying up more and more property in the United States, even though currently home prices are extremely high, because they are realizing that those extremely high home prices are really pushing out home ownership. And really what we're seeing is a really important shift as home prices become more and more unaffordable, as they become really the dream of home ownership is just that, a dream for the vast majority of people. It's even referencing the very, you know, kind of middle upper class, the well-to-do workers are struggling too, to be able to afford homes in their communities. We're seeing this huge land grab by these private equity firms who believe that really the norm will become renting. and that home ownership would become an uncommon thing, an unusual thing. And they're really kind of, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, of course, because these firms have far more cash than individual, you know, workers and buyers, and can buy up huge swaths of land, and really aren't interested in selling it. They want to rent it out because that's a steady source of income. You get a regular pay from your renters, and you get to hold on to the property. I think it's a really important shift to talk about because it speaks to the housing crisis and the crisis of home ownership, and it's showing that these impossibly high prices are causing home ownership to become something that belongs to private equity funds and hedge funds and things like that, who can actually afford them and are gaining a greater monopoly power over the right to home ownership, over the ability to live in a home.
Daniel, let me ask you about that. When Bill Clinton was president, money was easy to obtain. Banks were giving loans to every Tom, Dick, and Harry who walked in off the street. It seemed like American home ownership skyrocketed compared to previous levels. And then the economy crashed. Eventually, we had the housing bubble, and so many people were upside down on their loans that that half the economy seemed to have gone to short sale. So here we have the exact opposite thing going on, where we have Wall Street and the rich Wall Street bankers and investors buying up properties and pushing people into rental units because real estate, especially in the big cities, is too expensive. And so there is no opportunity to own a home for a lot of Americans. So which one is better for American citizens? Which one is better for the economy? Which one is better just for the long-term health of the country?
Yeah, I think it's really important. We don't want to, again, make some sort of false dichotomy that like a boom time is better than a recession or a recession is better than a boom time. Both of them have the potential to hurt people. During the boom time, credit was cheap and easy, right? And so everybody took out these crazy loans. But the problem is they sunk everything into this single piece of property and then they lost everything. Whereas these hedge funds and capital funds talk about that free movement of capital, they could move their capital out of those things. They could move their capital into other places. And they did, because certainly they weren't buying those homes to live in. They were buying those homes as an investment, unlike the people buying the homes to live in. But then during a recession, of course, everything crashes and no one can afford any credit and homeowners can't really afford, quote unquote, those loans. So that hurts them as well. Really, what we need to see is we need to see a government programs and government stimulus such that loan institutions and banks that make loans can be incentivized and have regulations put around them that will allow them or incentivize them to loan to people. We need more government programs that will allow people to get benefits, bonuses, tax breaks, or tax breaks be passed on to corporations so that home ownership can become possible. The problem is, though, that requires money. Now, the U.S. government has a ton of money, but right now we're happy to spend more than half of our budget on war, on weapons. And when you do that, there's not a whole lot left over for programs like this. So that's a huge problem, is where our collective money is going. And we as taxpayers, we pay tons of money into it, and it's all going to war. So there needs to be a movement. There needs to be a fight to say, look, the wealth is there. The money is there. Let's use it to give people houses, because that's a human right and that's a human need, just like food or community that people need. So I believe that's really the real solution or direction, that real solution, when we recognize housing is a human right and we as a society need to dedicate resources to it. Right now, it's a speculative investment. It's a way to make money. It's not something for humans to live in and form communities. And that's a fundamental problem.
We're talking with Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst from Northern California. Daniel, real quick, as we want to cover some other stories too, John, I really want to get to what I consider to be just so important that
yes.
Amazon boss Jeff Bezos was briefly this yesterday morning the richest man in modern history. He went to $150 billion, but by mid-afternoon, it was down to $145 billion. So it was a dip. And I want to talk about that because it's so revealing, in fact. But before we do that, let's stay in on this topic of affordable housing. There's a ballot measure in California which tries to repeal, which will seek to repeal. This is for coming up in November. A California law, I believe, Daniel, you'll have to fill in the details here, that makes it illegal to impose, for any part of California to impose rent control on any property that was built after 1995. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That is currently a measure on the ballot where they're trying to push back this kind of rent control that we've enjoyed for so long. it's going to be a huge problem if it actually goes through. I mean, rent prices are currently out of control in the Bay Area and many cities, you know, DC, New York, the list goes on. And that law would inflate home prices even more. It would ensure that even rentals become exorbitantly expensive. So even the people that can afford them are going to be spending 50, 60% of their income on rentals. And then for people that can't afford thousands and thousands of dollars a month on rent, they get nothing, right? They get homelessness, they get shelters, they get halfway houses, and they get pushed out of the communities. So that would be a huge blow against working people who are frequently needed to rent.
Let's go to the Jeff Bezos story for a second. I mean, Jeff Bezos owns Amazon. He owns the Washington Post. He now owns Whole Foods. He has a $600 million contract with the CIA. So I'm going to read a couple words, and then I want to comment on this phenomenon. Jeff Bezos, the Amazon founder and chief executive, is certainly having a happy prime day today. According to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, a daily tracker of the world's richest people, Bezos was worth more than $150 billion this morning, which made him the richest person in modern history. The achievement even takes into account inflation, when Microsoft founder Bill Gates was worth $100 billion in 1999. That wealth would equate to about $149 billion. Now, let's say you take your money and you invest your money so you don't have to work. You become a coupon clipper, right? You know, you put your money in stocks and bonds. Let's just say everything's booming like the stock market is, and you get a 10% return on your investment. If you invest $150 billion, because it's not just sitting in a bank, it's invested money, at 10% return, if Jeff Bezos went into a coma, well, not into a coma, let's say he went to sleep for a year and he got 10% return on his $150 billion investment, that would make him $15 billion richer during the next year while he's sleeping, while he's completely asleep. I mean, that's the nature of capitalism, where the aggregation or accumulation of money capital by the capitalists, by the bankers, or these monopoly corporations led by these people like Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates. That's why we're in a situation where 90% of the population family income average is $30,047 a year, and you have this kind of obscenity, where society's resources, which are finite, are so distributed to the already fabulously wealthy. I mean, richer than all the kings and queens of the foregone period of history. It's really gross, but it is the system.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a couple of things we need to point out here. One of them is, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We still have this insanely stratified class society where people like Bezos and Gates have incredible aggregate power and wealth to them. I mean, we look back at the feudal times and, you know, kings with giant piles of gold around them while serfs in their fields starve to death and scrape to get by. And, you know, it's a sort of caricature of how awful things were back then. But, you know, how really fundamentally different is it now between people in San Francisco, of which there are thousands who are homeless, forced to eat garbage and whatever, you
it's
know,
not different.
Together
it's
in the
just the method of exploitation is different. We're not serfs. We're not tied to the land.
But the outcome is the same.
The outcome is the same. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, exactly. And moreover, $150 billion, that's more money than a GDP of dozens and dozens, perhaps hundreds of countries around the world. I mean, think about that for a moment. An entire society of people, an entire culture, a country, a people is in under these terms worth less than a single human being, in this case, Jeff Bezos. I mean, does Jeff Bezos produce more value in the world than the millions of other people that populate these countries? Well, billions, actually, that populate these other countries. Did he work harder than them? Does he make more wealth? Or can he just go to sleep and make fantastic sums of money investing, you know, his $150 billion in a simple little 10%, you know, return? That's the type of system we live under, where people are forced to rent and laws are repealed that prevent them from even getting some kind of basic rent control, while Jeff Bezos has more money than he could ever spend in his whole life. He could live a life of opulence, of wealth, of untold pleasure, and never even put a tiny dent in it. Meanwhile, other people are asking themselves, how am I going to you know, pay rent this month? How am I going to have enough groceries for my kids?
643,000 Americans had to declare bankruptcy this year because they couldn't pay healthcare bills.
Exactly. And there's people that are saying, how do I get a doctor to pay for it? Do you think Jeff Bezos will ever have to worry about that? I mean, Jeff Bezos could foot the healthcare bill for, you know, entire states or entire countries, depending on the country you talk about. He could pay for all of them to get, I don't know, dental care or some kind of needed surgery for cataracts or something like
or
that.
Or give those Whole Food workers or Amazon workers a decent wage instead of them having to slave all day. And especially the Amazon warehouse workers, I mean, really not able to live. That's not enough money to live. I mean, that's why his wealth went to $150 billion today. There's real value being created, but it's being created by workers in warehouses or Whole Food workers who are at the cashiers or stocking the shelves. I mean, they actually do the work. If Jeff Bezos did go to sleep for a year, let's say he just went to sleep, you could still shop every day at Amazon or get your packages delivered from, I mean, at Whole Foods or get your packages delivered from Amazon. But if the workers go to sleep, guess what? You won't get anything because the workers actually create the value. It's their labor that creates the value. Daniel Sankey, 20 seconds. Take us out.
Yes. And I think really what this makes us need to realize is who has the power here and who has the strength, who makes it run. And that's the workers that do it. And it's time that the workers started realizing it and taking that power to themselves and doing something about it.
That's the big need. The labor movement has been so set back that it looks like all power, the seeming omnipotence of these big, you know, barons, the capital barons of today, and yet workers do have power. It's an unrealized power. It needs organization. It needs unions. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. He joins us every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.